All right, so today I will talk a little bit about quantum Monte Carlo methods. Sort of the idea might have been of that of talking more in general about many body methods, but you know, it's so vast, the area, that it's very difficult to get a reasonable description within a limited amount of time. So I will focus on this particular algorithm that was actually discussed, introduced yesterday by Giuseppina. I mean, you saw where quantum Monte Carlo methods essentially plays in all this business of trying to solve the maximum possible accuracy the Schrödinger equation. Then I will show also some result on lattice nuclei, depending on how much time it will take to me for all the rest. So, broadly speaking, the talk will go like that. I'll just say a few words to introduce the whole subject and then give a general formulation of quantum Monte Carlo methods. Because, you know, this is also one of those fields in which there is a lot of ambiguity, because there are actually zillions of different ways of doing quantum Monte Carlo. And every time you hear someone talking about quantum Monte Carlo, you get the impression that, you know, these guys don't know what they are doing, because one is doing this, one is doing that. The other one is says, well, hey, guys, I can do everything perfect. No, there is some problem. No. Typically, we fight among us, but we should try not to convey this idea outside of the quantum Monte Carlo community. It's interesting, because we have quantum Monte Carlo meetings, you know. It's like a completely separated world in which people fight among themselves about what you should do to do this calculation. So it's very interesting. And physics doesn't matter in that. It's all technical, mostly technical in many cases. I will explain, you probably know, many of you know this, why nuclear Hamiltonians are so hard to be treated within these methods. Some workarounds. I will say a few words about where quantum Monte Carlo is generally drifting these days, which is essentially going away from formulations in which you use coordinates of the particles. Now you start essentially working directly in the Fock space. You have an Hamiltonian, you have your states, and your random walks are defined in as random walks in the Hilbert space with some representation. And this is very general. It has some advantages, some disadvantages. It seems to be a way to cope more efficiently with the same problem in certain cases, although machine-wise it might become more expensive and blah, 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 a few words. And then I will also tell you about some physics and what we try to do for making some connections with lattice calculations, lattice QCD calculations, and what you can actually do, or we hope we can do. So the idea is very simple. You have your essentially, for the moment, we limit ourselves to non-relativistic quantum problems. You have n interacting particles. So you have the Schrödinger equation. The Schrödinger equation has a kinetic energy, has a potential energy. The potential energy could be anything. So the two-body potential, 3, 4, 5, n, with operators, without operators, whatever. you want to solve the Schrödinger equation. So the idea is quite simple, and it's the idea that is beyond essentially behind. Sorry, it's behind the lattice QCD calculations as well. You put yourself in the Euclidean formalism, and you propagate. Or say this is also sort of related to the fact that nature wants to drive systems to the toward equilibrium. And if you look at the canonical quantum formalism, for instance, when in the thermodynamical the treatment of thermal systems and then in quantum mechanics, you get essentially the very same idea out of there. So the idea is that essentially you have some propagator, which is essentially a propagator in imaginary time, that when applied to an arbitrary state, essentially projects out of these states the components with the lowest eigenvalue. It's very easy to see from this expression that if I decompose this initial state in eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, the coefficients here all decay exponentially. And if I'm able to choose a suitable normalization, I will be able to make at least one of them survive the ground state. So this is the general idea. If you propagate for an infinite imaginary time, what you get is a projection onto the ground state. Actually, not necessarily you are limited to compute the ground state, because if I'm clever enough, I could take this initial state confined, strictly confined within a certain Hilbert space. And of course, this projection will lead me to the state with lowest eigenvalue within that specific Hilbert space. This procedure has the advantage on one side, disadvantage on the other side. It cannot create any component that is orthogonal to the initial state. So if my initial state is orthogonal to the ground state, I will never end up in the ground state. I will end up somewhere else. And it might even be interesting, this, because in principle, this could be used to compute excitation, but you have to be very careful here. I mean, this is...
Even numerical errors would not bring you to a ground state.
What say it again?
If you do numerical errors.
Yeah, no, but that's, okay, I will discuss that. I mean, no, I'm just discussing in principle, if you really, the point is that you have to know that your function is completely orthogonal to the ground state. That's not possible in general, okay? But in principle, you can do that.
I guess it works when you've got some other conserved quantum number and you can make sure that that conservation is preserved.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. But even in that case, it's very hard to construct a wave function that has exactly no component along the ground state. And this has to do with the zeros, where you place the zeros of your functions. If your zero is wrong, the nodes of the functions are wrong, this means that automatically you have a component along the ground state. So that's all the origin of the sign problem. I will discuss this a little later. But what I'm saying is that in principle it would be possible. Another important consideration is that, yes, this ground state is the absolute ground state of the Hamiltonian. This is a mathematical statement, it's not a physical statement. So one of the big problems is that Hamiltonians do not distinguish between symmetric and anti-symmetric states. And the ground state of the Hamiltonian, regardless of the symmetry, is always a symmetric state. This is a theorem. So, of course, already from the first line, one can see all the limitations that this technique has. I want to be clear and not try to sell anything. Okay, I will try to give a talk as the talks we can give to a quantum Monte Carlo audience, not to a general audience. Oh, one interesting thing, you know, is that all this is extremely general. I don't need to mention the details of the Hamiltonian or the specific representation of the Hilbert space.
At all point. Yes.
Yeah, you must have a ground state. Yes. No. Well, of course, but fine. Fair enough. It's not relativistic, yes. Yeah, well, okay. The important thing is that I don't need to, I'm not referring to coordinates, to momenta, to anything specific in that sense. Okay, so the idea of quantum Monte Carlo methods, or better projection Monte Carlo methods, is to implement this propagation in a stochastic way. Now, at this point, you start having the big branching in methods, methodologies. Because depending on the specific representation you take, the kind of propagator, the way in which you write down the propagator and the propagation, you have different flavors of quantum Monte Carlo. And the principle is always the same. What he does is exactly, in that sense, is exactly similar to what I do, but he does implements this propagation a different way in which I do, with a different way in which other people do, and so on. So that's the very general idea. So from this point on, I'm talking about some specific flavors of quantum Monte Carlo, and there is a whole world outside that Dean will say a few words about other flavors, and there will still be something else that will not be told around here. This is important. I mean, I'm sorry to be pedantic here, but the one of the big problems typically that we have is that people do not recognize this fact that there is no one single way of doing quantum Monte Carlo, and although the principles is always the same, and of course, the results have to be always the same because you pretend to essentially implement the same procedure eventually. But technically, there are very different ways of doing it. So it looks like everyone is doing something different. No, it's not different. It's all technical in some sense. Okay, so the idea is that this stochastic implementation means that I have to sample a sequence of states in this Hilbert space. And each one is essentially sampled, starting from the previous one, according to the propagator. So the propagator gives me the recipe for sampling the next state in my Hilbert space, given the previous one. It's a transition matrix, essentially. What is called a stochastic transition matrix. So,
the guarantee that you are not stuck in a false vacuum.
No, you are not. In fact, this is one of the typical problems that you have to face in some case. Be sure that there are zillions of these pitfalls. I cannot go through all of them because otherwise it takes I take a course typically in 48 hours course to teach 30% of the stuff. So there is no time. So if you want to use coordinates, coordinates are eigenstates of the position. So the idea is, okay, I represent my Hilbert space in terms of eigenstates of the position. The formulation is very simple. First, we say, okay, I have to represent my initial state. And I represent my initial state as a collection of points. So this means that I simply decompose my state in over a finite sum of delta functions. Of course, this is an approximate representation of this wave function. The wave function will be given only by the integral over. So I have to take the basis is infinite, and I have a continuous quantum numbers essentially, but it's convenient to restrict to approximate this wave function over a finite set of points. And so essentially, this is the wave function. Here I have called the R, capital R, the coordinates of the particles, the three-dimensional vector. For the moment, allow me to leave aside spin and isospin. We will come back to that later. At this point, I have the representation of the wave function, and I want a representation the same on the same basis of the propagator. So I need to compute this propagator to estimate this propagator. And this is very complicated. This is typically cannot be written down analytically, no way. The only way you can write it down analytically is to take a short time approximation with sort of contradiction of what we want to do, because we want to project for an infinite time. But if you want to use this, we have to take a short time. So, however, in this short time limit, fortunately, there is a way of writing down this this propagator, and this will be made up by a kinetic term, which is simply Gaussian. In this case, and it's a real Gaussian because we are in imaginary time. And a factor that contains essentially the potential, the interaction between particles, and this normalization is zero. Is zero, it's clearly related to the ground state eigenvalue. But if we start calling it the ground state eigenvalue, immediately you say, hey, guy, that's what you want to compute. How can you use that? So the real point here, the point here is that this is not, I mean, or is not necessarily the eigenvalue. Eventually, it will be, let's say, but this is some number that I have to put in there, whose function is to guarantee that the normalization of the state I want to project on is preserved. Okay, that's the. So it's just a matter of, because the propagation, this propagator is not unitary. This is the big problem. The propagator does not preserve the normalization. So if I don't apply something that preserves the normalization, I will end up with zero or infinite. As normalization. So I have to tune it up a little bit. Okay. So the role of this construct is to guarantee that the normalization is preserved, and not necessarily this is immediately the ground state eigenvalue. So how does it work in practice? Okay, it's very easy. In this simple formulation, we said that our wave function is essentially represented in terms of delta function. So I have a point in space. So I have first to apply this kinetic propagator. how do I apply this kinetic propagator? Well, this kinetic propagator simply smears out this this delta function with a Gaussian that has a width proportional to the square root of, oh, there's a square missing here, sorry about that. It's the Hilbert square over M. Proportional to this imaginary time step, the square root of this imaginary time step. So actually, this is a genuine diffusion process. And you recognize that it is a diffusion process simply thinking that if you drop the potential in your imaginary time Schrödinger equation, you are left with a simple diffusion equation. And actually, h bar square over 2m plays the role of a diffusion constant. This is interesting because there are a number of problems in which you might be interested in knowing, for instance, the effective mass of your particles. You can actually get the effective mass of your particles just looking at how these particles diffuse around. So this is somehow an ingredient, but how you dress up, I mean, this mass can be dressed up, and you can get it back. I mean, you can get the effective mass by looking at the diffusion constant, at the computed diffusion constant. This is very interesting. It has been used in several cases. Okay, once I diffuse this particle, so diffuse means that simply that I take a Gaussian, I know how to sample a Gaussian, it's very easy. I pick up a random vector with Gaussian components, I add it to the current position, I get to a new position. Now I have to implement this guy here. So this is diagonal, for instance, in the coordinates. So this means that I will have essentially, this doesn't give me a further displacement of my point. It rather represents a sort of probability of my point of surviving there, a weight of the point after this time interval delta tau. Actually, I have no time to go through this in detail, but one can show very rigorously that this term is indeed related to the normalization of the state that you're generating after this propagation of delta tau. So essentially, the idea is that I start from a set of points. My function has a certain normalization at a certain point. I propagate it of an amount of delta tau, and I get somewhere else. Actually, each point will get some place. What is the normalization related to the new point, which I need to know, because whatever I want to compute, then we'll have to take into account this normalization. Well, the normalization is given by this factor. So I interpret this as a sort of weight. If the normalization is 1 at a certain point, I propagate, I get somewhere else. The normalization has become 1/2. This means that, in general, I would expect to generate 1/2 of the points with respect to what I had at the previous step, at that time. Of course, I cannot, since I'm propagating a point, I cannot take my point and cut it in two. I have to apply some other procedure. The procedure is stochastic. I simply decide that with probability 50%, I keep my point, or I simply cancel that point. This means that if I go over that same point 1,000 times, about 500, I will get one point. About 500 times, I will get 0 points. And on average, I will obtain the correct weight of the point. Same thing if the normalization is larger than one. In that case, I will compute the probability of generating either one or two or a certain number of points, depending on how large is the new normalization of the state. So at the end of this procedure, some points will be simply erased, taken out of this initial population that was representing my wave function. So some other will be multiplied, in the sense that from one point I will get two, Some other would simply remain the same point and would continue its walk, its own walk. So you have this procedure, diffusion, branching. We call this branching. And this procedure, of course, propagates the wave function of a step delta tau. What do I do to reach the large delta tau limit? I simply iterate this. Very simple to say that, I mean, if I simply take this propagator and split it in a certain number of equal replicas, each one of for a time t tau over m, so some large number, I will obtain altogether, and I insert completeness in between. I will obtain a sequence of propagators all the same, all for a small time step delta tau. This is perfectly legitimate because I'm not separating the pieces of H. I mean, each one of these propagators for a smaller time step will commute with all the other ones. So it's perfectly legitimate to break it up. It's a typical path integral procedure. And in fact, I mean, one way of writing down this propagator is to write it down as a path integral in imaginary time. It's what you do, essentially, right? This is a perfectly legitimate way of writing down the propagator, which is different from this one. This one relies on the fact that I can advance of one step at a time. You could write it down as a long chain of propagators that give you some kind of path in space.
In a sense, sampling of each delta region, you're not doing that independently, right? You're using the first delta tau
yes.
at some point and then evolving the next delta tau.
Yes, yes. It's a chain. It's really a.
So the thing you start off with, the delta function, is just for the first step, is that?
Well, it's for the first step, but essentially what you do is that the wave function of the next step will be represented by another set of delta functions. I mean, because you keep sampling points in configuration space, in coordinate space. So everything is a way. It's an intelligent way of sampling, essentially, that does a projection in the meantime.
So if you have a good guess for your initial state, you can do that.
I will come to that. Of course. Now, just to complete the picture, as he was pointing out, what I'm getting is a collection of points. Asymptotically, after a certain number of steps, these points will all sample eventually the ground state. And what do I do with this collection of points? Well, what I do is to try to compute expectations in a Monte Carlo sense, which means I compute some operator and I sum up the values, I average them, and this will give me essentially the expectation value over the ground state in this case. Well, over the ground state is a little tricky in this case because, you know, what I'm sampling is actually the wave function. Remember that I have said at the beginning that the ground state of the Hamiltonian is always a symmetric, so positive definite function. I'm still under that hypothesis. So what I'm sampling in the end here is not the square modulus of the wave function, it's the wave function, okay? So if I want to compute an expectation, I would like to compute integrals of this kind. Let me... So this, for instance, would be my entity. Okay, but the problem is that I can sample only one of these, not the square modulus all this. So actually, I need to use some function, some known function that allows me to compute the energy. In Monte Carlo sense, if I can sample this guy here, the expectation, this integral is estimated by points sampled by from this function. And values of the function, of the integrand, evaluated over the points that they have sampled. So I sum up all the values of this object here. This will give, from evaluated on points sampled from here, and this will give me this integral, which is the numerator here.
How do you guarantee that the faces are the same?
Right now I'm talking about the ground state.
Yes.
Everything has to be real, okay? Positive. I will come to that. I have slides on what happens when you are in a more complicated situation.
And you have to tell us what psi t is going to be.
Psi t is an arbitrary function. It's a completely arbitrary function. Yeah. Okay?
That you choose.
This can be something very close to the ground state, could be a constant, it could be anything you want. The point is that when I compute this ratio here, I'm actually computing this matrix element, and by hermeticity, because I have the exact wave function on this side, I will get exact value, eigenvalue, ground state eigenvalue. The Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is the magic. I don't need, in principle, to know the exact wave function to get exact eigenvalue. That's an important key point here.
Just needs to have the ground state, doesn't it?
Yes. Right. I mean, of course, this has not to be orthogonal to, because otherwise, what I get here is a zero, and this means that I have an infinite variance. This is a nice exercise that I always propose to students, because all this seems to be very abstract, but if you think of a simple Hamiltonian, you take the one-dimensional harmonic oscillator. So you start your calculation from a set of points which is distributed uniformly in some interval. Okay. The green line here is the histogram of the initial distribution, completely flat on this line. Then you take these points and you start evolving them according to this procedure. What happens? I mean, you take the first point. You diffuse it, it will go, for instance, this way for a little bit. Then you have to compute this weight. The harmonic potential is a parabola here. The eigenvalue is somewhere here. If this goes too far, the difference between the potential and the eigenvalue becomes positive. So this means that the weight is small. So this means that I have a quite large probability of canceling, of deleting this point. Vice versa, if I go towards the center, I have a probability, an increasing probability of generating more and more walkers, more and more points in this region. So what happens is that this flat distribution transforms itself into the correct distribution. You start from a flat histogram, then after a few steps, you start having more points in the center and a little less outside. Well, actually, this is the second step. This is a small modification. Then you start modifying it a little bit. After 10,000 steps, essentially, after 1,000 steps for this specific calculation, you obtain a configuration distribution that is essentially Gaussian. And after 10 times more steps, you are obtaining the very same distribution again. You have converged to the ground state. Here, there is a line you cannot see probably, but there's a continuous line here that is the Gaussian, the actual solution. And, I mean, you think of it 5 minutes and you realize that this is perfectly working. Now I need to compute the energy. Move the figure. Just to make an example here, I used as a function, as a psi t, 1 over 1 plus x squared. It's a bell-shaped function, but it's not a Gaussian at all. This is very wrong. It sort of resembles the ground state, but it has nothing to do with the ground state. Okay, and what I'm doing here is to plot the energy as a function that I get as a function of the imaginary time. As you see, the energy is falling down exponentially. Oh, this, by the way, is the logarithm of the energy. It's not the energy, it's the logarithm of the energy. It's falling down and exponentially with several powers. And this is interesting because first you have a very sudden decay, then you have a decay which is a little slower than you have a decay. And then eventually the energy gets flat. Oh, there is a line at the wrong place because I moved. That has a point. It wasn't a 0.5. No.
You wonder why we don't believe it.
The green line is the actual. This would be the exact result. What I wanted to show, you are.
Sorry.
I wanted exactly to show that there is still some problem here, in the sense that you see that this result here doesn't go exactly to 2.5. It's a little bit higher. And if you let it go, it will keep being higher.
Is it guaranteed never to drop below? In some variational sense.
There is a bias here. There is a bias which comes from the fact that I'm using a finite time step. The breakup that I do of the propagator is not exact. It's exact only at order delta tau. Okay? So this simulation was done with a delta tau which was pretty large, over the typical scales here. And I did it on purpose just to show that one has to be very careful. It's true that, I mean, you think of it, it works. You get a nice Gaussian, wow. Very nice. But you see here that even for a simple problem like that, if you are not careful, you have to be careful to take into account the fact that you have some residual bias that comes, for instance, in this case, from the finite time step, from the fact that I'm using a finite number of points. Here the number of points doesn't matter too much because of the yes.
Just to answer Judith's question, you can drop below the energy because you're doing an estimate of the integral. You're not actually calculating the level.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay, yes.
So that means, for instance, you wouldn't be able to get the right integral by saying, all right, let me take the lowest one of all these random squiggles. You'd get it wrong.
Yeah.
Because from that particular graph, it looks tantalizing.
It does.
That would work.
But in any case, the point is that what you can do is to make an extrapolation in this case. Of course, this affects the statistic, the error bars you have. Because each one of these points will have an error bar, statistical error bar. The extrapolation will have a larger error bar, okay?
So this is like a finite layer spacing effect. So you have something effectively equivalent to the semantic actions. And
yes. Yes. Exactly. Mm-hmm. You can cure this by improving the action, for instance. So you can use. You can improve this applying acceptance rejection exactly so that this gets the dependence becomes quadratic in the time step. So essentially, after a while, you get something flat within error bars and so on and so forth. I mean, there are recipes for making this better. But what I wanted to point out is the fact that one has to be very, very, very careful about this kind of details. It's not something that is simple to implement and you just.
To improve this Hamiltonian order A, what would the operator look like?
You mean order delta tau?
Yes, if I wanted to do the improvement and define an improved X and improved Hamiltonian A.
It's not the Hamiltonian, it's the propagator.
Hamiltonian is the propagator.
So
you would put something in the Hamiltonian.
So my question is, is there an improved?
You can for the harmonic oscillator, you can compute the exact propagator, which is sort of a linear, I mean, it's like a triangle here. And if you sample from that, you have no errors whatsoever. Here you can, it's one of the few cases in which you have an analytic solution for the propagator.
But you could also just go back to the Trotter-Suzuki formula and figure out exactly what the corrections are from the
or
kinetic energy.
Yes.
Right.
Exactly. You can also do that. Yes. There have been several attempts to introduce explicitly the commutators, for instance, in the propagators, so you can go beyond that.
But you can't do it at the level of the effect of Hamiltonian? You can't do
it? What do you mean by an effect of Hamiltonian?
So let's QCD, for instance, you improve the action order by order. Right, so at the end of the day, observables are improved in given order. So here, you can do the same thing, improve the Hamiltonian to improve your propagator.
Yes. In fact, I mean, all right, yes. There are, rather than improving the Hamiltonian, say, what you can do, for instance, is to take some approximation, like if you have, for instance, a pairwise potential, you can sort of do things like, I compute a propagator for the two-body system only, and then I take, this has to be numerically, it's not analytic in general, but and then I take the action as the product of this pair actions, essentially. So you do some sort of mean field-like treatment, or say cluster expansion of the potential, and you compute the propagator on that, and then you use that. This is done commonly when you do calculations with Coulomb, with the Coulomb potential, for instance. Because the Coulomb action is relatively easy to compute. And especially if you do path integral-like calculations where the sampling of the propagator becomes horrible, then you really have to do that if you want to be able to sample anything. Otherwise, you don't move. You simply don't move. And of course, if you improve the propagator, you improve also the efficiency of the propagation itself. I mean,
I guess if I was looking at this, I would guess that the correction has looked like a squared with four derivatives or something like that.
Yes. You can compute it in an. But see, I mean, this is sort of misleading case because for this one you can actually do the exact thing, and then it's not particularly. Oh, role of explicit wave functions. This is another very confusing issue. Because we keep talking about wave functions. And I just told you that. A, I can get numbers which are independent on the wave function. So what's the deal here? Now, the algorithm that I've just shown you works only for the harmonic oscillator, essentially. Not much more than that. Because if you think of any realistic interaction, this will have some hardcore, or there will be some attractive part, or whatever. This means that this weights, this term that gives me the branching factor, so that contains the potential, can in principle fluctuate arbitrarily. And this means that I can have huge explosions in the population, or just all the population dying off because I get in some bad place, or so on and so forth. So it would be desirable that you have some guidance in your work. And this guidance can be introduced in a simple way. So essentially the idea is that your propagation, if I write the propagation in an integral form, so sort of imagine of being able to sample all over the space and continuously, so I substitute my sums with integrals, so the propagation, the psi r delta tau will be the integral of dr prime e minus h minus e zero times psi r prime zero. So what I do here is simply to take some function. This psi t now has better to be some realistic representation of the ground state, which I can get from a variational calculation, for instance, or whatever. I multiply inside and outside the integral by this function here. And within the integral, I simply multiply and divide by the same function computed in R prime rather than in R. What happens? It happens that, you see, this propagation is a propagation of points that generates a distribution that is proportional to this function here. It's a product of this function psi r delta tau, which eventually will go to the ground state, and this importance function here. The propagator itself is modified. You have no longer the basic propagator. You have this factor, which is the ratio of this trial function, essentially, this importance function, say, in the old, in the new and the old position of the worker, which has an obvious role. If I'm moving towards places where the wave function is low, I will tend I can include this in the branching factor, in the weight. If I go towards places where the wave function is low, my weight will be suppressed, and I don't go there. If I go towards places where the wave function is large, the branching will be enhanced, and I will create a lot of points there. So this sort of gives some information that is useful to avoid sampling in a completely blind way the space.
So is it in general in the language where these people are using, for example, you know, to get faster, you know? Yes, it's convergence to the ground state, optimized trial state. So yeah, essentially, this is a form of, in general,
you call this importance sampling. I mean, this is when you want to sample some event space, and you have some functions that tells you where it's worth sampling and where it's not.
And basically, if I would not introduce the Charles function, just, you know, look at the Euclidean.
It's a little different,
But it's not so different.
Okay, so there are two different things you can do to optimize. One is to start off with a better initial state, and that's more like in elasticity, the interpolating operators you use. So that's a direct connection. What he's talking about here is actually doing a transformation of the operators. What you do is you divide by a guess of what the ground state is on the right, and then you have the operator, and then you multiply by the ground state wave function on the left. It's like a similarity transformation. It's a transformation of the operators. And what that does is it allows you to guide the configurations better. So it's more like when you do hybrid Monte Carlo last QCD, to go for the important configurations rather than the happy ones. That's what's more like.
Yeah.
But in hybrid Monte Carlo, last QCD,
this function that I'm using here is not is then divided out. I mean, whenever you, I mean, this is a general way which you can operate. This if you have a propagator of any kind, you want to generate a distribution according to that propagator, you can always use an importance function. The important thing is that you divide it out in the end. And in fact, I mean, here, the idea is that, I don't know if I have a slide for that, probably I haven't. No, I haven't. Let me write it down on the board. The idea is that my expectation of the energy, which is still a matrix element, is still something like it as before. But what I wanted is, I want to have psi zero on this side, only psi zero on this side. So what I'm doing here is that I'm sampling according to psi 0 r, psi t of r. This is the distribution that I'm sampling. And I cannot disentangle these guys in principle, because I never see psi 0. I just sample this stuff. But then here, I can use the same function, but divide by this function here, and then integrate. And the same thing will be here. Well, actually, the denominator is already automatically the correct one, because I'm sampling this. This object here, actually, all together, is the probability that I sample. This is the normalization, essentially. So you see that what you need to compute is no longer h psi t, is h psi t over psi t, because you have to divide this out. If you divide this out, then it's like you didn't do anything, essentially, to your distribution. This is the important. I mean, you can. This is. You have an infinite number of degrees of freedom here. You can modify your algorithm as you like. You can multiply by all the factors you want. The important thing is that you divide them out at the end. In fact, this is not always exploited as it should be.
You can also kill your sampling by getting psi t completely wrong.
Oh yeah, of course. Yes. But in some cases, instead, you can improve your sampling by doing some non-trivial transformation of using not just a psi t. I mean, you can also use some more correlated beast. This is very important if you want to deal with the sign problem, for instance, where you can play games of this kind. You know. Of course, there is no reason to hurt themselves. You have to take psi t as good as you can. The better it is, the better accuracy you get, and the less computer time you use. So it's extremely important. That's another point that is overlooked many times. To perform a very, very accurate variational calculation. The better are your wave function, the better off you are. So this diffusion procedure should just be the very last step of your calculation.
Putting in psi t here, this obviously changes the statistical distribution you get of
Mm-hmm. This one, yes.
How do you propagate
that uncertainty? But as I say, what you do then is to divide this, to divide it out. When you divide it out, essentially it's like if you had only this one. Of course, the uncertainties get in here, because you know this guy here might, in principle, have much larger fluctuations. On the other hand, if psi t is really good, h psi t over psi t is almost constant. That's another advantage. I mean, h psi t over psi t is the eigenvalue. If you, in principle, if you have the exact function here, there is no variance. So this is what we call the zero variance principle. I mean, if you can build an observable and mechanism that gives you zero variance in some limit, you're in a very good shape, because essentially you can then try to push your calculation toward that limit, and you're guaranteed that you will have a huge improvement in the statistics. Fortunately, not all the observables are the same. Energy is easy. Some other observables is easy. Others are terrible in this sense. So, oh my God.
The introductory fairy.
Yeah, too many questions, you know. It's always like that. I mean, I don't know. I would assume that everyone knows this stuff at this point. I've done this talk so many times. Anyway, why is nuclear physics difficult in this sense? Well, sorry about using argon potentials, but it's still old school a little bit. The structure of any modern potential essentially includes operators, and this was done for let me just keep this and go directly here. The point is that when I use the diffusion Monte Carlo scheme, I need at this point to explicitly introduce also the spin isospin degrees of freedom, because the potential explicitly depends on spin and isospin, so the propagation will affect also the spin isospin state of nucleons. Typically, in the propagator, I will have a factor that is like this. I have the nucleus in certain positions, and in a certain spin state, or what's this side, sorry. I apply the propagator. Since the propagator contains the spin, I will, as a result, obtain the nucleus at the same position. This is diagonal in the position. And a new set of values for spin isospin. Okay, what is the problem? The problem is that, for instance, if I have a term like e to the minus sigma e dot sigma j, this guy distinguishes between the singlet and triplet state, for instance, of pairs of nucleons. The problem is that I cannot operate. I mean, this, the result of this operation does not involve only the spin of one nucleon at a time. So the result is that I have to consider all the possible states, single triplet states of all the possible pairs within the my system. And I have to build up a wave function which essentially is made up of as many components as all these possible states of the nucleons. And this propagator is a terrible matrix that acts on this multi-component function and eventually give me a different wave function. For three body, typically this is what you have. If you apply, for instance, I don't know, sigma 2 dot sigma 3, over this vector of the, each one of these are essentially the wave function of a triplet, if you want, of nucleons. What I get is a state like this, which is completely different from this one. You mix in the various pieces, so you cannot just say, okay, I take this vector and this one will be transformed into this, this one into this, and this one into that. You really have to act over all the components of the function at once. And this means that the dimensionality of the problem and the dimensionality of this matrix grows very quickly. It actually grows exponentially with the number of nucleons. This is a table that shows you how many numbers you need essentially in this vector to correctly compute the propagation. For the alpha particle, you have just 16 numbers. In lithium-6, it would be 32 by 6, yes. In beryllium, is 128 times 14. Beryllium-10 is 1512 times 90. Carbon, it becomes 2048 times 132. In oxygen, this would be already 32,000 times 1400. And if you go to calcium, you go 10 to the 21, 10 to the 9. And this is the big problem here. That's why if you try to do the point is that if I do this, I can actually operate with the correct propagator on the correct wave function. Everything is nicely defined. But I'm strongly limited by the number of particles that I can treat. This is a huge computational challenge, and this is what the Argon people did for the last.
How are you actually doing research with normal charges? For example, work with normal momentum. By that, momentum always is assumed to be an attraction of local.
Yes. Oh yeah. Well, in this case, this is another issue, because everything is local here.
AV10 is local, isn't it?
AV18 is local. Is local. Yes. That's not. But that, for instance, is like essentially it's like Nabla square. So it's like an effective mass, for instance. You can manage, and some part is, in any case, is perturbative, as you know. The Argon people, Bob and Steve, do calculations with only, I think, AV8 prime and sometimes L square in the propagator. The remaining part is treated perturbatively. So also here there are some. Okay, this plot is very well known, but there is no way to go beyond that at the moment. I mean, there has been no progress for the last, I don't know, how many years.
Just with that counting, so that was just the spin, plus spin, but the number of, the representation in space, that's sort of, No more difficult than what you were talking about before.
No. Because that factorizes out. What doesn't factorize out, unfortunately, is the.
There's no algorithms to take you with reduced.
This one, you mean?
Complexity from A to A plus one.
You mean this one?
Well, let's see.
No, okay, there has been some progress actually, but changing a little bit the scheme. And the idea is that you can use the Abbas-Tatonovich transformation and transform this propagator that is quadratic typically in the spin operators into something that is linear in the spin operators. There is a price to pay. The price to pay is that you are introducing more variables. Introducing more variables means introducing more variance. And not only that, there is another issue here, which is very serious. And the issue is that you are going from a complete basis to an overcomplete basis. And if you're using an overcomplete basis, you're no longer guaranteed to be variational. Okay, so this is something important that, however, we think it's relatively under control right now, in the sense that the idea is that this Arbat-Stratonovich transformation essentially allows you to work on a decomposition of your space in terms of single particle spinors. And this means that the operation now will not longer be a propagation of this whole vector, will be essentially, by sampling this auxiliary variable x, a sort of rotation of the spins. So you sample, rather than summing up over all the spin states, you sample your spin states by rotations of the spin. And this is much more convenient in terms of the computer time you need. Okay, this is the auxiliary field diffusion Monte Carlo. So this is the sort of the next generation in along this way, in this style, one of the possible ways of dealing with the problem. Now, this has been set up in such a way that it's very well scalable. The cost is a cube, not 2 to the a as before. So you can access actually larger systems. We have had problems over and over, for instance, with the wave functions, because the wave functions at the beginning that we could use were very poor. But now there's been a lot of progress in the sense that you can introduce correlations with the operatorial, at the operatorial level, not just central correlations. Nuclear spin orbit is along the way. Three-body forces have been largely improved lately. So in the last 10 years, there has been a lot of work on this since the original introduction of the method. And this is maybe not still at the stage of function Monte Carlo completely, but we are getting very close in terms of reliability. So, of course, here there are all the details that there is no way I can tell you because it takes time. But I mean, you have to trust us a little bit at this point. Sign problem. Yeah, a couple of words on the sign problem, at least. What is this infamous sign problem? It's nice, because every time I give a talk, every single time, there is a question about the sign problem. 90% of times, some people do not know what the sign problem is, so it's pretty interesting. Because there is this simple idea that, if you have an anti-symmetric function, this is positive, this is negative, and you cannot sample it. All right. This is a bit naive in the sense that, okay, let me just tell you what a better understanding of the sign problem is, because it's not just a problem of anti-symmetric functions per se. The same problem is related to what I was saying at the beginning, that the ground state of the Hamiltonian is a symmetric function. So whatever else I want to compute is an excited state, including the ground state of fermions. The anti-symmetric ground state is an excited state of the Hamiltonian. And unfortunately, the Hamiltonian doesn't know anything about the symmetry, doesn't know about the Pauli principle. This is crazy in some sense, but The Pauli principle, and this points to the fact that probably this is not the, the correct equation to use, by the way. Okay, so the problem is that if you, if I apply the propagator here, okay, I could try the, to use the following trick. I start from a function that has the correct symmetry, which is antisymmetric, and I apply the propagation, okay? Now, if I sort of try to stabilize the coefficient of this state, what you see here is that this coefficient will be eventually asymptotically be constant. In principle, if I have any remaining component along the ground state, which is symmetric, this will grow exponentially. Well, you might say, okay, I have to compute an integral like this. I take an antisymmetric function here, and I'm done. Because the components, the integrals involving here, psi t, which is antisymmetric, and this piece here, gives zero for symmetry, by symmetry. So what's the problem? Michaelos tells me that, like in sometimes in the early 70s, people were positively convinced that, that this was not a problem at all. The problem is that I don't need just the expectation of the energy, I also need the variance. Because I have to give an estimate for the error. I mean, I have fluctuations. Fluctuations, unfortunately, come from the square of this quantity, which is always a symmetric quantity. So fluctuations will always increase exponentially. So the sign problem is essentially related to the fact that the signal-to-noise ratio that you have when you try to stabilize the component along an excited state will decay exponentially to zero. This is the sign problem in this exception. Also here, there are many sign problems. For this problem, for this kind of algorithm, this is what we call the sign problem. So, I've been working 20 years almost to try to solve this thing. There are many people around trying to solve this problem, but so far there is, I mean, there are some cases in which you know that there is a solution, some cases for which the design problem is not effective, but in general this has not been solved. Someone says that this is completely unsolvable, I do not agree. Some problems are unsolvable, some others maybe are not, and so on and so forth. So we are having also workshops, entire workshops on this team.
This reminds me of Al Kalos gave a lecture one time when he concluded by saying that he had solved the sign problem.
I myself said this thing several times, but it depends on what you want to sell. Sometimes you have to do that, you know. No, I mean there are some cases in which you can get a solution. The problem is the scalability of the algorithm, as usual, because you can have solutions that are okay for some problem, but that, when you scale them, the cost scales exponentially. So that's.
So presumably the results you showed a couple of slides ago, the authors were convinced that they had the psych problem under control.
Let me go through this, because the sign problem is never under control. However, sometimes it is, but Okay, you mean that they are gone results. For instance, they use what is called a transient estimation, which is like an unquenched calculation QCD, if you want. And the results they give for at least the lightest nuclei are obtained essentially trying to make an estimate of the result without constraints. In some case, what you can do is to do this procedure, to apply this procedure, still having decent statistical errors. However, this is not a solution of the same problem. I mean, this is a case in which, well, it's what, hey, I mean, if you look at lattice QCD calculations, it's the same thing. I mean, you're trying to get to a plateau before everything blows up. And that's exactly the same thing here. You can do exactly the equivalent of an unquenched calculation in some sense, which by, according to what I would define, it is not a solution of the same problem. If you want a solution of the same problem, the error has to go down as 1 over square root of the number of samples you take. Anyway, there are some workarounds that you can apply. And these workarounds are usually based on the fact that, again, you have a decent, very decent guess of your wave function. So the idea is that you can use either the phase if your wave function is complex or the novel surface if your function is real of a test function to constrain your calculation in within a region of space, if you want. Within which the solution is possible. It's possible to show, for instance, that if you have the anti-symmetric ground state, and the ground state is real, for instance, for the Coulomb for Coulomb systems, if you take a pocket of a given sign for the wave function. Plus or minus. All the space is covered by replicating this pocket and tiling up the space with this pocket. This is what's called the tiling theorem. For the ground state of an Hamiltonian, anti-symmetric ground state of a Hamiltonian is always true. Now, it's easy to realize that at this point, if I solve the Schrödinger equation within one of these pockets, so applying some artificial boundary conditions would say that the wave function is zero, where the nodes of the function are, and it's zero from that point on. What I will get is essentially the solution of the problem, because I have solved the problem in that region of space, but it replicates everywhere in space. And the eigenvalue is the same. Also, this can be proved. I mean, it's mathematically provable. So you have a way of solving your problem with some artificial boundary condition. Boundary conditions. And the solution you get is equivalent to the solution of the whole problem. The idea is that you have to know what the nodes of the function are in this case. Something very similar can be done for complex functions, where the nodes are replaced by essentially the phase of the function.
So if you get the nodes wrong and you do a sampling over all different locations of nodes, can you then interpolate to get the right answer?
Yeah, that's a way in which this has been tried, for instance. The problem is that nodes are nodes in a multidimensional space, so it's very hard to. For some simple chemical systems, for instance, this has been done. You can actually go and manipulate your nodes and variationally try to get towards the right answer. Oh, one important thing is that if you do things in an appropriate way, these estimates are a variational. Either in the nodal structure or in the phase. So there is a way in which one can make these results in any case upper bounds of the energy, which is very important. Just a few words. I don't know if I will have any. No time. A couple of minutes more, just to show this, and then I will shut up. As I was saying at the beginning, quantum Monte Carlo is going a totally different way these days. People are very focused on the fact that you can give up on this coordinates description, and you can use some more general representation of the Hilbert space. So the idea is very, very similar. You sort of apply a propagator in your Hilbert space, and you get a random walk that is actually equivalent to the random walk you have in coordinate space in some sense. The only thing that you need to know is how to compute the matrix elements of this propagator, essentially, as we did before for the coordinates. So I am not giving you any detail. We have been playing around with this kind of algorithm, actually. Let's just keep this. And just a couple of words here. You can build up propagator. These are formulas in which it seems to be easier to take care of the sign problems. Since you can apply, for instance, some extrapolations that should give you an almost exact answer. within this formalism, you can use very easily non-local Hamiltonians, because the only thing that you need are matrix elements of the Hamiltonian. We did calculations with non-local Hamiltonians. You have the possibility of using representations which are the most diverse, harmonic oscillator biases, Gaussians, hypospherical harmonics, if you want, or if you have infinite system plane waves, BCFs, states, whatever. And actually, yes, the interesting thing is that this opens a whole world, especially in nuclear physics, because quantum Monte Carlo calculations were indeed limited to local interactions, but that's no longer necessary in some sense. And we did calculations, for instance, with N2LO OPT in the non-local version.
So what's actually the trick?
The trick is that you do a calculation in momentum space rather than in coordinate space.
So you don't need the condition that your potential is diagonal.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Well, because in configuration space, you need that, because essentially you have to write down your propagators explicitly in coordinate space, if you want. If for instance, if you use momentum space, the trick here, if you want, is that the propagator is written in terms of matrix elements. So as long as I can write down the matrix elements of the Hamiltonian, I have a way of applying the propagator without needing much else, because it's heavier memory wise and but not CPU wise somehow. This is very similar to some sort of diagonalization techniques, because if you apply 1 minus delta tau h, this is like applying the power method. It's linear algebra method almost, okay? But you do it stochastically, so it's not extremely heavy. Okay, and we did some calculations. I mean, here there are some references and so on. So, unfortunately, I couldn't give you details here. This might have been more interesting. I have zero time at this point to talk to you about physics. I'm sorry about that. I know also some physics, but I don't know if anyone is interested, because you know that's what I was going to talk about essentially. Let me just read one slide, maybe. One curiosity. Yesterday I was writing down, the spell checker changes pioless automatically in pointless. And this, I hope this is not a message for everyone. Painless is a... Okay, just to show you that right now we are trying to do calculations with oxygen 16 with a pioless interaction which is directly linked to the lattice QCD calculations. However, we are still in a shape. I mean, this is, if you look at these graphs, they very much look like unquenched calculations in QCD, right? Some sense. We have the same kind of problems. Now we are trying to work this out by improving the wave function. We have actually done that. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to generate any plots in time. But the idea is that here there is something very fishy that is going on, which is the fact that if you use the standard wave functions for oxygen. Okay, this is the 4 alpha threshold. And this is the result that we get with a constraint calculation. It looks like oxygen is not bound. It would decay with the pion mass of 800 MeV. Okay. The interesting thing is that this is how the density evolves with the imaginary time. And it sort of tends to create some, there are huge fluctuations in the center here. I interpret this as the fact that this would probably really break up in 4 alphas. This might be quite interesting because there is something very interesting at this point, possibly, in the extrapolation from this high pion mass calculation down to the physics. The chances are that the alpha particle is so bound in this fake world that the physics would be completely different. So there is some phase transition somewhere. So this is, I think, it's a real challenge. I mean, there is something that one has to understand in this region. I mean, this can be seen only if you do 8-body, 12-body, 16-body calculations.
So you must have done the alpha, and the alpha is...
Is okay. Yeah, I mean, okay. The alpha
is... very strange because, you know, classical nuclear physics calculations of oxygen 16 as an alpha bound state work really well.
Yes. But, I mean, for the alpha particles, we have results that are pretty much within what you expect. The alpha particle is
Yeah, then you'd expect that it should work for 16 too, just because of what's...
Well,
what's binding the alphas? That mechanism would seem... Mm-hmm. Not the alphas themselves,
standard.
But one to the
other.
Standard.
One to the other, that's the point. I mean, it might be that the alpha particle is so tightly bound that actually at that point it's dedicated. It's true that even in a physical case, the binding energy is 10% below the alpha particle, the 4 alpha threshold. So
it's ancient history, but you know the Yale group was all agog about 40 years ago about alpha cluster models.
Some people are still doing them.
Yeah, well, then there is also, of course, I mean, the you need to go...
That's
correct. In fact, we are trying to introduce also the next two leading... We are doing the work for on the next two leading order right now, and, I mean, yes, with all the caveats, of course. That's
if you and the organizers are willing, I'd like to hear for the second
half of the talk
sometime. Oh, gosh.
Detail, right, of how this happened and what might have gone wrong. What a burden. Well, the
lights are ready, so... Maybe nothing's wrong. Maybe it isn't bound with empire.
No, that's the real point. I mean, maybe it's like that. But it's like, if it is like that, it's interesting because somehow it means that you have to be careful in extrapolating physics from this limit to the physical case.
So Francesco, we've seen something similar to this. So we have a paper on, we can actually induce the phase transition to make
okay. 16
unbound. It's a quantum phase
transition. With the alpha particle, you are using the alpha particles.
Okay, so what we find is that by changing the locality or non-locality of the short range particle, you can actually, the alpha particle remains completely the same, but the alpha-alpha interaction can be shut off by that process. And that actually induces a phase transition. So that may be what you see.
That may be, that might be. And this would be interesting because it means that there is some general feature that pops out at that point.
So presumably you can get rid of some of the sign problem by only using anti-symmetric basis states when you're working in configuration space, but from what you
yes,
before,
yes. In fact, that's the
they're
the,
still
the,
going to hit you with the
exactly. Yes. The point is that at that point the propagator can change sign, but then there is a trick that you can apply, and essentially the extrapolation there seems to be much more reliable than say, for instance, fixing nodes or phases. Or, so it's a very promising way to go. But all the quantum chemistry people are all going that way these days. That's the new fashion in quantum Monte Carlo, essentially.
So I kind of have a technical question. When I look at one of these effective mass plots that you have in the nuclei, in the distribution you have this with the signal takes over, what is the distribution of the contributions that generating the derivatives?
You mean these ones or the oxygen ones?
Yeah, so for instance, something like that, what is the distribution of events underlying each of those as I move in imaginary time?
The distribution with respect to what?
So I have a central value and I have some distribution to give this uncertainty.
Yes. I mean, the problem is, as you see here, these data are strongly correlated. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit hard because the correlation time here might be quite long. So for instance, this run here is a bit short to make this kind of analysis here.
But if I was just to pick one of these things, mm-hmm. I just pick one and then ask, what is the distribution underlying?
Essentially becomes it's still Gaussian, but it's very, very broad at this point.
It really is a Gaussian distribution.
Yes. Every time. But that's because essentially of the central limit. I mean, you're still the central limit theory is still good for each of these samples. Essentially, the point is that
it's
the variance that blows.
So in lattice QCD, you don't see that. You see symmetric but non-Gaussian distributions at large times.
But that's because of the autocorrelations mostly, I guess. Also in your case.
No, I don't think so. You can just show by looking at the moments of the distribution and the correlator that has to look. So that's why I'm asking.
honestly, I never did this analysis, but yeah, it might be interesting to check it out, actually. If you have the
okay.
suggestions, but...
Yeah, let's thank Francesco.